way when somebody has an experience of this kind, he just has to tell everybody about it. Because you see, he sees everybody around him looking dreadfully serious, looking as if they had a problem, looking as if the act of living were extremely difficult. But from his standpoint, the person who's had this experience, he feels that they look funny, that they don't understand, that there isn't any problem at all, that he has seen from where he stands, you see, that the meaning of being alive is just being alive. That is to say, I look at the color of your hair and the shape of your eyebrow, and I understand that that is the point. That's what we're all here for. And it's so plain, and it's so obvious, and so simple. And yet here is everybody rushing around in a great panic, as if it were necessary for them to achieve something beyond all that. And the funny thing is, they're not quite sure what it is. But they are devilishly intent upon it, after that thing. And so, to the person in the state of consciousness, which I call mystical, that all seems very weird, very absurd. But it's not something that you criticize in an unkindly way. You don't say, those damn fools, those idiots. You say, it's such a pity that they don't see it. Because although they are going around in this wildly ignorant pursuit, one of the funny things about it is that they don't realize that there is a dimension, a sense in which their pursuit is magnificent. It's to give an obverse sense to the saying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Turn that into its opposite. Not forgive them, but give them a blessing, because they don't know what they do. Give them an honor. In other words, the intensely serious preoccupations and anxieties of mankind appear from this standpoint, not to be foolishness, but to be a kind of marvel. In the same way, perhaps, as you could say, that the protective coloring of a butterfly who has somehow contrived to make its wings look like enormous eyes, so that when a bird who is about to devour this beast is confronted by these staring eyes, the bird is a little hesitating, as when you stare at somebody, they're always taken a little bit aback. And so the butterfly appears to stare at the bird. And perhaps you see this phenomenon of the marvelous staring wings of the butterfly is in some way a result of anxiety, the anxiety to survive all the problems and struggles of natural selection. Nevertheless, in this intense struggle, we are unknowing poets. You see, one of the greatest ideas in the world that has ever been produced is, for my thinking, the Hindu idea that the world is a drama in which the central and supreme self behind all existence gets lost and involved. And pretends plays that he or it, or he, she, or whatever you want to call it, is all the creatures that there are, and gets totally involved. And thus, you see, the more involved, the more anxious, the more finite, the more limited, the infinite manages to feel itself to be. The greater the artistry, the greater the depth of the illusion which is created, for you see, all art is in a way illusion. The art of the magician is the art of illusion, the art of misdirecting attention so that a magic seems to appear. And so in this way, the more there is anxiety, the more there is uncertainty to that degree, the play has succeeded in the same way as when you are watching an actual play or reading a novel or a movie. The more the author or the actors manage to grip you and to persuade you just for a moment that you are actually involved in reality, the more they have succeeded as artists. You may have a faint recognition in the back of your mind that this is, after all, only a play. When you sit on the edge of your seat and you're sweating and your hands clutch the arms of the chair, and the scene so grips you, that is magnificent acting. And so the Hindus feel that the whole arrangement of the cosmos is something exactly like that. That when in the reality of actual life you are sweating it out and you are wondering whether this surgeon who's got to operate on you in a matter of life and death is a competent man or a charlatan, or whether the investment that you made is a good thing or whether it's going to make you lose your shirt, you see, all those matters of terrific crisis are exactly the same as when you're sitting in the theater sweating it out there. But now a far more convincing theater has been arranged, because, as the Hindus would say, that in you which is it, the basis of you, the thing that is real in you and that connects you under the surface with every other being that is alive, this is the player of the parts, this is the maker of the illusion. This is the player of the game which has got you involved in this mess and is living it up in the same way as those actors on the stage are living it up to convince you that this is a real situation. And this is very understandable, because basically everybody loves to play this game. The game of hide and seek. The game of scaring oneself. Running up behind yourself in the dark and saying, "Boo!" All children like to do this. And this is the most human thing. That's why we go to the play, to the movie, and why we read novels. And our so-called real life is, from the position of the mystic, an extension of the same thing. Because, you see, he is the person who suddenly has realized that the game is a game. You see, if the game is hide and seek, or if the game is lost and found, everything to do with the hide side or the lost side is connected with where we as individuals feel lonely, impotent, put down, and so on. All the negative side of existence. I have tried to show you at various times that there's really one simple principle that underlies everything, and it's so simple it's funny. The principle is, all insides have outsides. Because you see, you don't know that the inside is inside unless there's an outside, and you don't know that the outside is outside unless there's an inside. Okay, then you, as you ordinarily feel yourself, are the inside. You are the animate, sensitive being inside the skin. But the inside of the skin goes with the outside of the skin. If there weren't the outside of the skin, there wouldn't be no inside. And the outside of the skin is the whole darn cosmos. Galaxy beyond galaxy and everything, you see? And that goes with the outside, in the same way that front goes with back. So that if you wake up and understand that, you find that the two are one and the same identity, one and the same self, one and the same life. So that's the mystic's point of view. He finds that out. Now, if I may switch, what is morals? In the sense in which I am using the term morality, or morals, it's a set of rules analogous to the rules of language. Now, it's perfectly obvious, isn't it, that we can talk to each other in English only if there is mutual agreement among ourselves as to how to use the language. What words refer to what experiences, and what ways of stringing words together to be meaningful are to be used. And it's very much of interest that we don't have too much trouble in coming to this agreement about language. We don't find that the police have to enforce grammar. The school teacher, yes, for little children, the school teacher does sometimes have to enforce grammar and say in an authoritative way, and in the old-fashioned schools with the aid of some implement of corporal punishment, that you use the correct grammatical forms. But when we grow up into adult life, we use these grammatical forms without much difficulty. And very rarely do the police have to enforce it. But it is otherwise with other arrangements that we have to make in common. Because just as we have to agree in order to communicate about language, we have to agree about, say, the rules of driving on the highway, the rules of doing business, the rules of doing banking, and so on and so on, the rules of family arrangements and whatnot. And these are actually rules of the same kind as the rules of grammar. But alas, this is not very often recognized, because the authority, the sanctions, the power behind these rules is different from the authority behind grammar. What I mean is this: if you transgress the rules of grammar, people will shrug their shoulders and say, well, he doesn't make sense. They won't summon the police. But if you transgress the rules of driving on the highway, or the rules of finances, someone is likely to summon the police. And so one sees the authority of the state as standing behind those rules. And there are other rules where our society sees standing behind them not the authority of the state, but the authority of the Lord God Almighty. So that if you transgress those rules, you're in danger not simply of going to jail, but according to your religious persuasion, are frying forever in hell, or on the other hand, of failing lamentably to be a real person. Now, the problem is this. Where the domain of mysticism and the domain of morals come into conflict. You see, throughout the all known history of religion, the mystics have been suspect. Insofar as religions have been the upholders of moral rules, the, as it were, the guardians, the authorities, in the same way, for example, as the lexicographers or the grammarians guard the rules of grammar and expound upon them, so in the same way the priesthoods and the lawyers guard the rules of social behavior. But when into the domain of religion there appears the mystical experience, then the priests are very, very disturbed. Now, you all know that in recent months in California, there has been a very strange outbreak in the most respectable of all churches, the Episcopal Church. Various congregations of the Episcopal Church have had a phenomenon called glossolalia, and this means speaking with tongues. If you will turn on your radio to any Negro revival meeting on a Sunday night, you will hear glossolalia. That is to say, when the preacher starts talking sensibly, but the congregation gets more and more enthusiastic and says, "I hear you. Amen. Yes, Lord," and so on. And it works up the preacher so that by the time he's through, he's not talking sense anymore. He's just lolling. He's going through glorious nonsense. In other words, he's become all the dry theological categories have turned into not only poetry, but beyond poetry, into music. And he's just saying, you see, he's just going like that. And the congregation's behind him, and it's wonderful. You see, he's become at that moment one in spirit with the universe, because that's what the stars are doing. The stars above us, the galaxies, they're not making sense. See? They're making a colossal display of fireworks in the sky. See? It's going like that. Well, it so happened that in recent months, various congregations of the Episcopal Church had outbreaks of this. The Bishop of California, when all this happened, Bishop Pike, wrote an encyclical letter to his pastors and said, "With all due regard for everything, you know, we must not be too dogmatic. We must recognize always that the Spirit of God may work in mysterious ways that cannot be foreseen. And we should keep an open mind about all these matters." This was said in a very complicated way for several pages. But then finally, when it came to speaking with tongues, in effect, this must not happen in the Episcopal Church. Yeah, I mean, in effect, this was what was said. It was said, you know, the iron hand was in a velvet glove. But this mustn't happen. Now you see, this has characteristically, through the ages, been the attitude of priesthoods, of the guardians of law and order, or as they say in the Episcopal Church, everything should be done decently and in order. The guardians of this kind of thing have always been afraid of the spontaneous manifestations of the Spirit. Not only of things like mysticism, but also of things like falling in love. They are very, very dangerous happenings. And so here is an absolutely astounding paradox comes about. And it goes like this. We know on the one hand that human love is only genuine when it is felt.